Andrea Park, McDonald's unveils vegan burger in Finland. Bon Appetit magazine, October 6, 2017. What if McDonald's had amplified rather than tried to squelch McVegan? And what if it had developed the veggie burger first and capitalized on that market potential? The argument here isn't that we should welcome various ideas, even those that are seemingly clownish and out of left field, for the sake of being nice. Rather, through inclusion, companies can both react to market forces that are demanding a voice and stay competitive. Think how much easier it would have been for McDonald's to tap its marketing team instead of its lawyers, boosting the McVegan message, even celebrating it, and bringing the narrative under McDonald's own tent. Two columns, facts and narratives. Facts, right or wrong, logical, verified, stay rigid, exact truth, objective, depend on experts, countered by disapproving, tendency to exclude. Narratives, interesting or boring, emotional, spread, easily mutate, approximation of truth, subjective, depend on retelling, countered by drowning out, tendency to include. This idea of broadening one's scope to be more inclusive in the quest for greater effectiveness is what led to this book. It's what led General Dempsey to reach out to a Peace Studies Berkeley-teaching tofu-eating person like Ori to get his help improving the U.S. military's ability to function effectively. The Resolute Desk. Presidential administrations have come and gone, but the same desk, crafted from the timbers of the British ship HMS Resolute and gifted by Queen Victoria to President Rutherford B. Hayes in 1880, has remained a fixture of the Oval Office since the days of JFK. Kennedy sat at the Resolute desk when he deliberated how to deal with the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, and it was at that desk that he famously authorized the embargo of Cuba. It was at the same desk in 1987 that Ronald Reagan negotiated the terms of a nuclear disarmament deal with Russia. It was there, in 2013, that President Obama faced an issue no less challenging than the ones JFK and Reagan had to overcome. Just a few days before that Tuesday afternoon in April 2013, spring announced itself with the full glory of the cherry blossoms in bloom, but now the mood in D.C. and in the country as a whole had shifted dramatically. It had been less than 2 hours since the terrorist attack at the Boston Marathon. The president immediately assembled his closest national security advisors at a closed-door meeting. As he waited for the president to enter the Oval Office, General Dempsey looked to his right at Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense. Hagel was straightening his tie, and when he caught Dempsey's look, he slowly shook his head and sighed heavily. National Security Advisor Susan Rice, on his left, buried her nose in her briefing book, poring over the intelligence reports she had recently received. Every administration has its ups and downs, but the 9 months leading up to that meeting in April had seen one vexing national security issue after another. Dempsey knew that there would be intense interest in determining the motivation behind this new attack on American soil. He had received news of the bombing when his executive officer, Colonel John Novalis, interrupted his preparations for his testimony before Congress, scheduled for the next day. Novalis had just completed a tour of duty as commander of an attack aviation brigade in Afghanistan. He had been selected because he was combat-tested, virtually unflappable, and an exceptional leader. Dempsey knew Novalis would interrupt him only with something important. "Sir, there's been an incident," Novalis said. From his executive officer's demeanor, Dempsey could tell that what he was working on would have to wait. "There's been an attack on the Boston Marathon," Novalis continued, then explained as concisely and clearly as possible that there had been two explosions near the finish line of the Boston Marathon and that the attackers were still at large. The Joint Staff Intelligence Officer and Joint Staff Operations Officer were meeting and would come to him with their assessment in the next 15 minutes. While most of us will never bear the awesome responsibility of defending our nation's security, many of us have been in a situation where the status quo is suddenly disrupted. Dempsey had been trained over a lifetime to respond to exactly these kinds of crises. He knew that the Secretary of Defense and the President would soon summon their national security teams, and he must be prepared. Indeed, 90 minutes later, he was in the Oval Office. The media was already speculating about whether the attack was a result of U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East and whether it represented a new, previously hidden threat to the country's safety. All of that would play out over time. Right now, Dempsey needed to assure the President that the military was engaged, ready, and vigilant. A quiet moment passed before the Oval Office door swung open, admitting a clamor. A staff member in conversation with the head of the FBI, several phones ringing, interns talking in rapid succession. President Obama entered the room, loosened his tie, and rolled up his sleeves. In less than 2 hours, he would address the nation on live TV. He looked for a place to sit, but instead headed straight to the Resolute desk, leaned on its corner, and directed his first question to Dempsey. "Marty, give us your perspective." Most of us haven't spent a day in uniform, but from watching Hollywood movies, it's easy to assume the head of the U.S. military would be a hawk, constantly pushing for aggressive combat operations. In reality, however, in the past 10 years, Dempsey had learned much about both the capabilities and the limitations of military power. Nevertheless, he had to lay out all the options for the President. He had been with the President in other crises and knew that what he valued in these situations was clarity and brevity. "Mr. President," Dempsey began, "military personnel are providing support to law enforcement officials in Massachusetts. As you know, the Massachusetts National Guard has mobilized several hundred troops. We're coordinating closely with the Department of Homeland Security. The Global Response Force remains at its normal state of readiness. We will accelerate their readiness timelines," he continued, explaining that key parts of the military were being placed on high alert. "There are several things I will recommend if we receive intelligence that indicates the attack was part of a larger coordinated campaign, or if it is accompanied by an increase of hostile activity toward our interests overseas. These could include ordering Strategic Command to maneuver satellite coverage and Cyber Command to shift assets to reinforce the FBI and Department of Homeland Security. It's too soon to tell for sure, but at this time it appears that the attack is an isolated event." Privately, though, Dempsey wondered whether intelligence would link the perpetrators of this attack to any particular terrorist group, and then he wondered if that really mattered anymore. He looked at the Resolute desk a few feet away and reflected on how many obstacles it had seen overcome, how many changes it had borne witness to during its time in the Oval Office. Over the next few weeks and months, it would become obvious that we were experiencing something transformative. Unlike the perpetrators of previous terrorist acts in the United States, the Tsarnaev brothers never received in-person training, neither at a camp nor through a network. This is where the threads of our story converge in an interesting way. Could it be that in order to fully understand what happened in Boston, and, for that matter, what happened at the Berkeley Milo Yiannopoulos protests, we need to look at the world through a McVeigan lens? Exactly 2 years after the Boston Marathon bombings, Ori convened a meeting at Harvard Business School where he invited senior White House officials, entrepreneurs, members of the Islamic community, media strategists, and policy experts to discuss how we might prevent an attack like the one in Boston from happening again. The group began by trying to understand how the Tsarnaev brothers were recruited to commit the terror acts in the first place. They weren't part of a formal organization that gave them commands, nor were they even members of an underground network that hatched a September 11th-style attack. In fact, the successful war against such terror networks had parallels, in a weird way, to what happened with Berkeley students for animal liberation. Like BSAL, starved for members, the terror networks had turned to technology and to narratives to stay alive. Just as Ori created McVegan shirts and stickers, terror group members were posting their content online and hoping for the best. In the past several years, more and more videos had been posted. And remember, top-ranked videos are by definition compelling and easy to mutate, or, more specifically, regenerate. The narrative continued to mutate until the Tsarnaev brothers learned from that content and committed their act of terror. In a very real way, the narrative had become the organization. The Harvard group recognized that you couldn't contain the narratives through conventional means. Eliminating them from one social media site was like playing whack-a-mole, as videos would pop up on another site almost instantaneously. Trying to debunk the message and win the debate only gave the videos more attention. That same year, a Palestinian stabbed a bus driver in Tel Aviv and posted the act of terror online. The terrorist had no organizational affiliation, and the video wasn't promoted by a group of people. Still, viewers were inspired to commit their own stabbings and post these new derivative videos online. Of course, positive content can spread in the same way. Think of the It Gets Better campaign. But just as after 9/11, we had to get our heads around the fact that a distributed network, lacking a leader and without infrastructure, was a force to be reckoned with, we now needed to start considering videos and other narrative-building content as their own entities. This brings us back to UC Berkeley. What if the protesters were actually organized, neither by centralized command and control organizations nor by distributed networks, but instead were led by online videos? Online videos make it easy to belong, to feel an affiliation with a story, especially a memorable one. Lacking resources, the weaker player will often resort to fighting a narrative battle because, unlike court cases or massive protests, producing a story is cheap and easy. The web and social media mean that virtually anyone can post a video story. Instead of relying on centralized distribution channels, video stories are easily disseminated among members of a network and beyond. All of these factors give video stories their own digital version of life. Think, for a moment, of a YouTube or Facebook video as a living organism. The more people watch the video, the more money the companies make. So the success of a video is measured in views or shares, and successful videos are promoted and thus make their way to even more eyeballs. To this end, a video tries to sustain itself through being watched and tries to keep the family line alive by the same means plants and animals do. It mutates and reproduces. A popular video that encourages the creation of derivative content lives on through its descendants. In other words, video stories want to be as compelling as possible and as mutable and replicable as possible. Back at Harvard, the realization that narratives had become a new type of organization also shed light on how governments and businesses alike can react to a market force that demands inclusion. Cole Roland Aprius, The Market Conditions for Inclusion.
"I came over here because it was quiet," shouted the Prius driver, apparently oblivious to the contrast between her words and her actions.
Dressed in all black, a blue cell phone in her left hand, the woman looked through her glasses with contempt. She was apparently angry at the driver of the pickup truck idling next to her in the parking lot.
"There was nobody here," the woman continued, "and you come up here with your gas-guzzling piece of S and your exhaust spewing everywhere."
Alarmed by the Prius driver's words and demeanor, the pickup driver immediately thought of her kids. Well, actually, first she picked up her phone to record the interaction. "Hey,
she said in a calm voice that would quickly turn heated. Don't you swear in front of my daughter. From there, the situation escalated.
Shut the F up, the Prius driver responded. You're mindless and you're ignorant.
The video, shot in 2014, went viral, gaining millions of views. The fact that the video went viral isn't all that surprising. After all, it showed a juicy conflict involving an apparent elitist scolding an apparently working-class driver in ways that were crass enough you couldn't help but watch. Prius owners are, on average, more wealthy, more likely to have a college education, and therefore perhaps more, well, elitist. In California, paying more for a Prius than an average family car affords drivers access to the carpool lane and exudes a certain air of status. You can't show up to a venture capital meeting in a beat-up truck, but you can certainly show up in a Prius. What was truly surprising was what happened as a result of the video spreading. All of a sudden, it took on a life of its own. As the Prius video continued to spread, local news reporters from across the country informed audiences about a new trend taking the streets and YouTube by storm. They called it rolling coal. For decades, diesel truck drivers had experimented with modifications to their trucks in order to emit additional clouds of sooty exhaust into the air. Prior to the summer of 2014, videos of the practice existed on YouTube with little to no viewership, and most consisted mainly of a tricked-out truck whizzing past an enthusiastic amateur cameraman as thick black smoke emerged from the truck's tailpipe or ancillary smokestack. But in July 2014, the EPA announced that the practice of rolling coal violated the Clean Air Act, which prohibits the manufacture, sale, or installation of any part of a motor vehicle that tampers with emission control devices. Diesel truck drivers turned to YouTube to make a political statement in response. Within days of the announcement, coal rolling videos became a viral phenomenon. Videos took such forms as coal rolling on a hot girl, where a male driver would pull up next to a female pedestrian, leeringly asked if she smoked, then blow a cloud of soot on the unsuspecting woman. Another variety involved a coal rolling supporter placing his or her face inches from the tailpipe of a parked diesel truck while a friend mashed the accelerator. One of the video's most popular forms was smoke attacks on Priuses and their drivers. Each video and its slight variations served as lifeblood for the overall anti-Prius narrative. A group of coal rollers even took a road trip to put some Prius-driving progressives in their place. They drove to, you guessed it, Berkeley, and coal rolled an anti-Trump rally. Now, think about this from Toyota's perspective. The spread of the coal-rolling narrative was bad for the Prius brand on two levels. First, every time coal-rolling gained a new fan, that was one more person who would never, ever, ever consider buying a Prius, no matter how well-built, reliable, sleek, or environmentally friendly it might be. And imagine the derision coal-rolling enthusiasts would heap on anyone in their circle of acquaintance who bought one. Second, especially in regions where coal rolling was really taking off, it could dissuade car shoppers who might otherwise consider a Prius. After all, who wants to be a target for that sort of thing? What could Toyota have done to combat the coal rolling narrative? Certainly no slick national ad campaign would do the trick. We'll soon see that for companies wanting to effectively engage in a battle of narratives, inclusion is becoming the new way of being heard. Part 2. Harnessing the Power of Inclusion. Chapter 3. The Economics of Inclusion. Participation, Personalization, and Purpose. In 2004, Maria Sipka sold her possessions in Australia, consolidated her real estate holdings, and packed two suitcases. She wanted to see the world. The daughter of Eastern European immigrants, she grew up in a household where dialogue about a variety of subjects, exchange of ideas, and community were paramount. One's job, as a member of her family, was to connect with others and try to have a meaningful interaction. Nearly a year into her trip abroad, she found herself in exactly this type of conversation with a 17-year-old who pulled a rickshaw in Mumbai. This serendipitous connection with the rickshaw driver will eventually lead us to understand how, in order to effectively communicate our message, in order to actually be heard, we need to leverage inclusion. Although her new connection slept in his rickshaw and sustained himself on scavenged food, Maria found in him a kindred spirit. "This young man had so much fire in his eyes," she told us. "My parents were refugees, and we had the same hunger. He had interests and ambitions far beyond his life as a rickshaw driver, but his lack of education and his economic background conspired to bar him from access to market resources and to many sources of information." Then Maria asked herself a question that would have ramifications on the rest of her life and large implications for our investigation here. She thought to herself, "How do I have an impact on this person?" Seeing an opportunity to connect individuals like the rickshaw kid with others who shared their passions and curiosity, Maria co-founded Xing, X-I-N-G, a European social networking site that allowed people to come together in groups dedicated to particular causes or interests. "When people congregate in online communities," she reflected, "they do so around their passion points. The more you exchange with people, the more trust you build, and the more opportunities come up." "I got a taste of the potential for networks to revolutionize how people connect around the planet," she told us. "We had thousands of people who joined groups around a shared topic. They were investing 5 to 10 hours a week into nurturing their audiences," she explained. After running the data, she came to a fundamental realization. People who belonged to groups were 9 times more likely to return to the platform. These thriving communities enabled Xing to monetize the community, charging companies for advertisements, be it to find candidates for a job opening or to introduce a new product, targeted to particular segments of the network. Maria took the company public in Germany in 2006, and by 2017, its stock had quintupled in value, and the company was worth well over $1 billion. The social network was minting money, and its advertisers were acquiring new customers. But many of the network's members, though they were finding meaning in the communities, couldn't reap the economic rewards of the network. It's not as if there are a lot of online advertisers trying to hire rickshaw pullers. The architects, the caretakers, the backbones of the community weren't getting any of the revenue. They were developing close bonds with one another, but were feeling marginalized, even though they were in reality a part of the majority. Such sidelining, we should note, creates target-rich environments for videos like those disseminated by ISIS. To be clear, users don't join ISIS because they're feeling disenfranchised on YouTube. Rather, YouTube enables people to bond over feeling excluded in broader ways. Think back, for example, to the pickup drivers who felt sidelined by the Prius owner. They felt attacked simply for driving the wrong kind of vehicle. Here's where Maria Sipka recognized an untapped market opportunity that will help us understand the economics of inclusion. If you're able to give a marginalized community, be it a group of voters, the employees of a company, or a segment of social media users, a chance to participate, to personalize the content, and to do so toward a common purpose, you can tap into an underutilized resource that can be harnessed very effectively using fewer resources. If ISIS could leverage videos to sign up recruits, why couldn't the same technology be used for good, providing community members with a revenue source and enabling businesses to better communicate with their audiences? "We started talking to all the group leaders," Maria recalled, "and they told us, 'We are not marketers. Can you help us connect with sponsors? We need to feed our members some sort of experiences.'" On the flip side, she continued, All these big brands like IBM and Cisco are coming to us saying, we want to reach your members within the group. These companies were looking to place ads carefully designed by advertising agencies to appeal to certain segments of Xing users. They were following the traditional economics of advertising. Exert as much control as possible in order to deliver just the right message to the target consumer. To potential customers, however, the end result of this traditional advertising often felt more like bombardment than anything else. Recognizing this, Maria decided to run an experiment. She partnered with Dove, which had just launched a campaign that ditched pencil-thin models and instead featured models who reflected how most women actually looked. Dove was doing a good job at developing content that mirrored its users. Maria had the idea to let community members actually create the content. The notion of recruiting influencers to pitch a product isn't new. Think of an athlete endorsing a pair of sneakers. You have Oprah and Kim Kardashian, who command $100,000 for mentioning a product in a single post, Maria explained. Then you have admirers who adore your brand. We decided to focus on the micro-influencers. Maria started including community builders who had previously been left out of the equation. In this case, stay-at-home moms. They have a passion point that overlaps with the brand. In partnership with Dove, those micro-influencers developed content about what beauty meant to them and shared it with their communities. They would earn a little money every time someone clicked on the ad featuring their content. A few weeks later, Maria reviewed the results. When she looked at the hard numbers, she recalled, I was like, there must be something wrong there. The numbers were so good that they were difficult to believe. Ads at the time had a 0.01% click-through rate, she explained to us. Direct response was 1 to 2%. When that micro-influencer-created piece of content from Dove was unleashed onto those group members, we saw a 25% response rate. So I tested again, and it's right. What blew me away was that not only did we get the group leader to tell the story to create the advertisement, but the members not only watched the video, they started creating the commentary around the videos, and these conversations lasted for days and weeks. You have a decentralized conversation that carries on the original message. In a sense, this is the bright side of the digital echo. This simple change, bringing in the micro-influencers, created a new opportunity to reach consumers and to do so more effectively and at a lower cost. Maria co-founded Linquia Influencer Marketing based on this concept. John Pollock, Maria's vice president of product, explained the challenges the firm faced in this new age of the digital echo. What excited me from a computer science engineering background is that this is a very challenging big data problem. How do you get in front of everyone, the entire audience for a brand? Originally, it was a few TV networks, and then it became dozens, and then websites. When you move into an influencer space, everyone is potentially a leader of a community. The number of conduits and touch points has exploded over this trajectory. If there are millions of people who we can call community leaders or influencers, who do we pick to pair with a brand? The brand wants to make sure that the spokesperson knows the brand well, and the influencer can't be authentic if the brand doesn't fit into the needs of the members. Maria added, whether you connect a group of scientists in Germany with a group of farmers in Botswana, it's through the community leaders and the decentralized approach that the entire power of the planet exists. Before, it used to be UN, big media, UNICEF. But now the key to influence is with these group leaders, because they're the ones who have the intimate connection with their audience. And then companies can leverage these storytellers. They become the creators of the story. They distribute the story in a highly decentralized way. Instead of going through a handful of media channels, we are going to activate 50 of these leaders, and they're all going to use their already built channels to create content that's highly nuanced to their audience, And it'll happen within a week. And it won't cost millions. This brings us to three central points of this book. First, not including, exerting control, comes at an economic cost, one that is increasingly difficult to bear and harder still to justify. Second, the way to thrive in the age of the digital echo is to bring a cause to a pre-existing community. That is, rather than trying to build a community around a specific idea or belief, identify existing communities with whom the cause will likely resonate. Third, and most important, although much has been written about diversity and the importance of inviting more people and more voices to the table, many of us have been viewing inclusion through the wrong lens. Inclusion isn't necessarily the opposite of exclusion. Real inclusion isn't about letting just anyone in. It's about understanding the pillars of participation, personalization, and purpose. We will catch up with Maria Sipka soon and see how she and her company Linguia have been able to make inclusion into a competitive advantage. But first, let's go along on a secret mission General Dempsey embarked on during his time as head of the U.S. Army's leadership and training. Participation, the general secret mission, leads to the Nevada desert. In 2009, U.S. Army General Martin Dempsey made a secret visit to a combat outpost nestled in the mountains along Afghanistan's border with Pakistan. He made the trip because he recognized that something was preventing him from seeing the actual state of events. The surprise he was about to encounter would permanently change how he viewed the world. Dempsey had begun his trip more than 7,000 miles away, at his headquarters in Virginia. He was constantly briefed on minute details of the ongoing operations in Afghanistan, but he knew that he needed to show up in person and see things firsthand in order to completely understand everything. At Bagram Air Base, the general transferred to a Black Hawk helicopter for the trip to the outpost. The smell of its fuel and sound of its rotors instantly took him back to his previous deployments, and he remembered what it was like being away from home, not knowing when this war would come to an end. He had chosen to visit this remote outpost because just a few days earlier, approximately 20 American soldiers there had been involved in a significant firefight with 50 to 75 Taliban fighters. From his helicopter, the general could see the Himalayan mountains towering to the north and vast flatlands extending to the south. But his attention was focused on the mountains and hills directly below. There, hidden among jagged rock formations, sparse vegetation, and scattered villages of only a few mud buildings, were narrow trails winding along the mountainside, an unimaginably harsh environment in which to live, let alone fight. The trails below were thousands of years old, part of an ancient network of smuggling routes along Afghanistan's eastern border. In another time and on another day, they would have been fascinating to study for the history and culture they would reveal. But for the past 10 years, they had served as a continuous and effective supply chain, providing the Taliban food, weapons, and ammunition. And at a critical choke point, a small hilltop that dominated the route, a group of American soldiers were determined to interrupt this supply chain. As the chopper prepared to land, the general spotted familiar faces from his advance team that had arrived the previous day. Standing next to them, shielding his eyes from the rotor wash of the descending helicopter, was the company commander, an Army captain. This 28-year-old officer was in charge of more than 100 men spread over several different combat outposts, each facing its own unique challenges. The captain was flanked by a dozen or so of his subordinates, who snapped to attention when Dempsey stepped out of the helicopter but didn't salute him, as they understood that, from somewhere in the surrounding hills, they were being watched. The captain extended his hand in greeting. His grip was firm, and his eyes revealed an unmistakable inner confidence and determination. To put this encounter in context, This captain and his men would have been more likely to run into Michael Jordan playing a pickup basketball game in a local park than to have a substantive conversation with a four-star general. There are only 10 four-star generals in the U.S. Army. To see a four-star this far downrange was a rarity, especially in the midst of a situation so unstable. Put yourself in the captain's shoes. You were in a fight for your life just a few days ago, and now you have to brief a general? Are you nervous? Are you excited? Or, more likely, are you doing your best to simply not screw up? Dempsey knew a lot about the situation on the ground, but he was here to figure out what he didn't know. In the early days of this war, in Baghdad, he had established a reputation for driving his subordinates to seek complexity rather than settle for simplicity. Here, on the eastern edge of the mission in Afghanistan, he wanted to learn from this captain how to deal with the complexity of smuggling routes along Afghanistan's border. If your opponent is bringing supplies via rail, you take out a few bridges, blow up a few kilometers of track, and you stave them off for a time. But here, when the army managed to block one path, smugglers would find a new one the next day. When one group of mercenaries was stopped, another would take its place. The captain led the way to the eastern edge of the combat outpost, perched on a hilltop and half the size of a football field. Along the way, Dempsey took note of the dirt-filled Hesco bastions that provided a makeshift fence around the outpost. The captain had also moved several six-man duck-and-cover concrete shelters into the outpost for protection against mortar and rocket fire, and these were positioned near the plywood huts that the soldiers used for shelter. This outpost was every bit of 50 kilometers from the nearest big forward operating base, FOB, with amenities like hot food, chemical toilets, showers, and internet access. There were no such conveniences out here, Dempsey knew. The men here rotated back and forth to the bigger base camp every week or so. When they did so, it was always by helicopter, as the routes between the two American camps were among the most dangerous in Afghanistan. At the eastern edge of the outpost was a plywood guard tower 15 feet tall, extending about 4 feet above the Hesco bastions. The inside of the guard tower was lined with sandbags. Dempsey negotiated the 8 rungs of the wooden ladder leading up to the guard tower. He could sense that his security team was a little nervous, not about the enemy, but about the condition of the ladder. Dempsey winked at his lead security officer, a giant of a man nicknamed Ox, as he headed up. Ox had been with him for 3 years and would stay with him through the remainder of his career. The view from the guard tower was spectacular. It overlooked a small valley probably 3 kilometers across. The combat outpost was at 8,000 feet elevation. The mountains across the valley rose up to at least 14,000 feet. It had the feel of looking into a great wall. 2 trails emerged from the massive earth wall and converged in the center of the valley floor at a small village of 10 mud huts. Only 1 trail emerged from the village. It passed to the left of the outpost at a distance of about 1,000 meters. There was no other way out of this valley, which is why the location of this combat post was so integral, and also why it was an object of such aggressive attention by the Taliban. Dempsey climbed down from the tower and walked back with the captain to his makeshift office. Sitting across from the junior officer, Dempsey said, "Okay, Captain, here's your chance to influence not only your own part of the mission in Afghanistan, but our entire strategy. What's going on? Tell me why you're here, what's your mission, do you have the resources you need, do you have the information you need, and most importantly, has anything surprised you?" As it turned out, this captain had already figured out an ingenious way to make progress in his area of responsibility. "I've come to learn that I need to assess the outcome of my actions in the context of how they're understood by the local population," he told Dempsey. "That is, achieving your mission, say, destroying part of the smuggling route, the system of trails, might bring significant military advantage, but if these actions disadvantage the local population, they would ultimately make the mission impossible to achieve." Put another way, The same mission outcomes could be simultaneously viewed as a victory and a setback. An analyst at the Pentagon might be pleased that a route was cut off, but if it was perceived by the locals as disrupting legitimate trade, destruction of the road would turn the locals against American forces. Where do we get such men as this? Dempsey thought to himself. Then the captain surprised him. If I may add something, sir? He looked at Dempsey. I think we may not be providing our soldiers the best possible training to prepare for this environment. Dempsey was impressed by the candor. You see, Dempsey was in charge of the entirety of the Army's training, doctrine, and leader development. That meant that each year more than 500,000 soldiers and civilians attended one or more courses under Dempsey's command. Think about that for a moment. 500,000 people. During any given 3-year period, every single officer, every single rifleman, every tanker and artilleryman, every truck driver, every logistician, statistician, and electrician was trained under Dempsey's watch. It was his responsibility to train people to lead in combat and in humanitarian relief and reconstruction efforts, whether they found themselves in South Asia, the Middle East, Africa, or the Korean Peninsula. It's important to pause here for a moment and note that the Army excels at training. It provides a host of very realistic scenarios where soldiers practice fighting in simulated wars. On a 198,000-acre installation in Louisiana, the Army runs simulated operations where soldiers jump out of airplanes, try to gain control of a village, and fight in close combat. An entire organization of their fellow soldiers do nothing but train to act as the enemy, and they get very good at it. Hundreds of civilians play the roles of villagers, warring militiamen, NGO staff, and local officials. The simulations and the mock battlefields are so realistic that occasionally people actually die during training. This brings us back to the fog of war. All of this training, at its core, has to do with the U.S. military's exceptional ability to leverage information. You want to gather and aggregate as much information as possible to avoid being caught off guard. You want it to be parsed by experts who can piece together a more accurate picture of the operating environment. Moreover, to stay competitive, you want to guard the information and prevent it from falling into the enemy's hands. Toward these ends, it makes sense to institute controls. The same, of course, applies across industries. A pharmaceutical company, for example, guards its research and data tightly to prevent competitors from producing a competing drug or predicting market trends. Control is best applied within hierarchical organizations, and Dempsey was the head of one very large organization. Here he was, though, being challenged by a 28-year-old captain for a deficiency in training. "I've had great training, sir," the captain clarified, almost as if he'd suddenly realized whom he was addressing. "We learned how to fight countries and how to fight organizations," he explained. "But we didn't learn how to fight networks." "I've actually just read a book that may interest you. It's titled The Starfish and the Spider." "Do you know the difference between a starfish and a spider, sir?" Dempsey had not read the book, but, interested in the path on which this young captain was taking him, he said, "Well, to point out the obvious, one lives in the sea and one lives on land, but I don't think that's the distinction you're making. If you cut off the head of a spider, it dies. But if you cut off the arm of a starfish, it grows one back." "Okay, I didn't know that, but I'll take your word for it. So?" "The important point here, sir, is that the starfish can regenerate because, unlike the spider, the starfish doesn't have a centralized head. It is a decentralized organism. The book I mentioned is pretty persuasive in describing what happens when centralized organizations, spiders, take on decentralized organizations, starfish. Think Encyclopedia Britannica versus Wikipedia. Think us versus Al-Qaeda. You ask what we need? I think we need to figure out how to train the Army to be more starfish-like." The captain went on to explain the book's argument that the harder you fight a starfish, the more distributed, and thus resilient and adaptive, it becomes.
Thank you, Captain.
You've made my trip here today an important one. Well done. From his multiple tours of duty in Baghdad, Dempsey knew that the most elite of the military's special forces were trained, educated, and equipped for dealing with networks, but he also knew that the captain was correct in pointing out that the knowledge had not been adequately shared and that the institutions of the military had not adequately adapted to this kind of warfare. A week later, after reading the book, General Dempsey called the author.
"Ori, we need to talk," he said,
in a conversation that offers us a major clue about exactly what happened in Berkeley and will illuminate a greater force shaping our world. "I'm about to drive the military toward this adaptation, this evolution I just read about," Dempsey continued. He paused for a moment and added, "I need your help." Several months later, they met in person. "Have a seat, Ori. Thanks for making the trip here to meet with me." General Dempsey wasn't sure what would come out of this meeting with Ori Brafman, but he discovered almost immediately that it would be interesting. Ori sat down in an armchair perpendicular to Dempsey, who sat facing the door. Ori blew by the pleasantries. Someone had told him that this four-star general's time was very valuable.
"Good to meet you, General.
I know you want to talk about my book and about decentralized organizations and networks, but I want to begin by telling you about Burning Man."
"Burning Man?"
"That's right," Ori said. "Burning Man. And about circles."
"Burning Man and circles."
"Well, I guess if you think it's important to start with Burning Man and circles, whatever that means, then have at it," Dempsey replied. "I've got just a little more than an hour until my next meeting, but I'm eager to learn in the meantime, and I hope I learn something useful," Dempsey thought to himself. Dempsey's executive officer, Colonel Pat White, a highly decorated combat veteran, stood in the doorway listening to this exchange. He was out of Ori's line of sight, but he caught the general's eye and held his hand up to the side of his head, miming a telephone. It was his way of asking Dempsey if he wanted to fake a phone call in order to break off the meeting. The general smiled and shook his head. It was lunchtime, so Dempsey asked if he could offer Ori something to eat.
"That would be nice,"
Ori replied, "but you should know that I'm a vegan." Dempsey leaned back on the couch to take stock of this writer, academic, entrepreneur, vegan. He could sense that Ori was a little bit nervous, speaking far too quickly and leaving everyone behind. "So, Ori, I feel like I already know almost everything about you, and I'm beginning to wonder if I need to send for a translator to be with us for the rest of this meeting. I can't imagine we have much in common." Then Dempsey laughed. With the tension broken, the meeting began in earnest. 90 minutes later, the two parted company, but this meeting would be the start of a partnership that is now approaching 10 years in the study of leadership. This inquisitive general and the Berkeley guru. When you think about it, and granted it isn't obvious, the Army and Burning Man have some interesting things in common. It's not the uniform, although you could argue that both organizations have one, camouflage for the Army, brightly colored fake fur for Burning Man, nor is it the need to cope in harsh desert environments. Admittedly, the Nevada desert is likely a far more hospitable place. What unites the two is that both are based on inclusion, but not in the way you'd think. We often think of inclusion as simply the act of not excluding, of not barring anyone. We thus associate inclusion with, basically, letting anyone in the door. But neither the U.S. Army nor Burning Man is easy to get into. The physical and educational requirements alone render 75% of Americans ineligible to join the Army. While obviously Burning Man attracts a slightly different crowd, making a trek to the Nevada desert also isn't something everyone can do. The kind of inclusion we're talking about isn't necessarily about admission. It's about participation. In the words of BurningMan.org, anyone may be a part of Burning Man.
We welcome and respect the stranger. No prerequisites exist for participation in our community. Think about the Army captain and his desire to effectively participate in helping his country's efforts in Afghanistan, and now consider the people in your organization. They need not be a part of every meeting, but are you enabling them to participate in furthering the organization's overall goals? Personalization. Humanizing the how. 20 years after having to deal with McVegan, McDonald's has recently had to contend with other detractors. In March of 2017, the company was promoting its special St. Patrick's Day mint shamrock shake. In a tweet, the company promoted a 10-second video of a red-headed man wearing a tartan hat and playing bagpipes through milkshake straws. Is it any wonder the company was harshly criticized for using Scottish symbols to promote an Irish holiday? Could it be, though, that McDonald's got into trouble because it was trying to control the brand? Traditionally, in order to sway public opinion, a company like McDonald's would undertake a strategy built around the old model for building a brand, a carefully structured message designed to reinforce certain attributes. The process is traditionally rather top-down, in the hands of the CEO and other high-level executives. But any misstep, such as using the wrong cultural reference, is judged as being out of touch. Maria Sipka's approach with Linguia is to turn things on their head. Take the example of the Freedom Unlimited credit card, which offered 1.5% cash back. Ads touting the benefits of what you could do with the cash you'd be saving were just noise among all the other cards offering various rewards. Consumers don't necessarily want to hear from a bank, and there was no reason to think they were eager to hear about this particular card. Instead of developing top-down messages, Maria gave influencers $50 and told them to go create an experience. Don't just go to a cafe, be creative, have fun, capture the experience. It's all around, adding a pep in your step, she told them. That instruction resulted in stories that reminded people to create moments in their day to have some fun. One was a woman and her boyfriend, Maria recalled. They grabbed a bottle of wine, went up a hill, and had a great conversation. It's all about the experience that gets created. Applications for the card skyrocketed because now consumers were receiving a personalized message, one that was tailored to them by people who were part of their community. From a psychological perspective, this approach might sound like a hard sell for companies. After all, on social media, big corporations are favorite targets for criticism, snark, even boycott campaigns. If you're already wary of being criticized when you show your face on social media, why would you want to go even deeper into that hole, surrendering control to strangers and not even knowing who will be creating stories about your product? Reflects Maria. When you're a brand and your media is highly centralized on your social channels and on your website where you invite people to engage, you're going to have a flood of haters. All the detractors, who are going to try to annihilate you in every shape and form. That's a given. Thus, when McDonald's turned to Linguia, you can imagine the apprehension the company's executives must have felt. What will the influencers say, and how much trouble will those messages get us into? However, something surprising happened. When McDonald's activated grassroots influencers and decentralized the promotion of the Shamrock Shake, only 1% of influencer-generated messages garnered negative comments. The explanation? A corporation is an easy target that everybody loves to hate. But who wants to criticize a flesh-and-blood person telling a human story? Reflected Pollock, what got me really excited is the democratization of content. Social platforms created ways to connect, which is the new age of media, having multitude points of contact rather than a single channel broadcast. I never thought that people's natural social connections, audiences, and communities could be used to channel a brand in the way that anyone with a room could be an Airbnb host And anyone with a car can be an Uber driver. Anyone who is a community leader can be an advertisement channel for a brand. Linguia's micro-influencers are stay-at-home moms, retirees, students. Not the kinds of people who'd typically be working at, say, an advertising agency, but they do have the time to develop content and are pleased to be included in the conversation. And as members of the communities they are trying to reach, they are much more likely than advertising agencies to come up with messages that are emotionally salient. Whether you're communicating with customers or managing employees, you can rely on inclusion to humanize your message and deliver it more effectively. Inclusion is about concentrating the what, as in the directive, the goal, and distributing the how. After meeting the young captain in Afghanistan and speaking with the Berkeley guru in his office, Dempsey introduced into Army training and education a concept called mission command. Tell your subordinates what you want accomplished and loosen control to allow them to develop strategies to achieve the desired outcome. Purpose: bringing the cause to the community. Traditional efforts to mobilize groups of people follow the assumption that once you've identified a worthy cause, whatever it may be, you must then build a community around it. The problem with this approach is that it's hugely time-consuming, and every new cause requires a new supporting community to be built from the ground up. But what if we flip this notion and bring a cause to a pre-existing community? Then the cause becomes the what, and the community, already vibrant and thriving, rallies around to determine the how. As a business, explains Maria, you need to have an ideology, and you need to inspire and inform your audience. You have to let go of the way the message is crafted, and you need to trust these group leaders who have opted in and who are going to go and tell the story. What are the pre-existing communities that exist within your organization? How can you harness their power by giving them a purpose aligned with the organizational goals? And who are the influencers within these communities whose impact you can tap? Audiences are much more diverse than you may expect, Maria explained. Maybe they all love nature photography, but they have such a large demographic distribution that traditional targeting isn't even effective. In other words, the people following a leader within a community may have a very wide variance among them, so you'd be hard-pressed to find a traditional channel that would effectively reach that whole population. Reflects Maria, the definition of a community leader is broadening. Anyone could be an influencer. If you're passionate about something and other people are passionate about it, and you have the discipline to post regularly, then you have what it takes. Chapter 4. The Cost of Control. The Element of Surprise. It's pretty incredible, Colin Hoy, a PhD candidate in neuroscience, said of the brain, that there's a couple of pounds of liquid squishy stuff that controls everything about us. As it turns out, our very own brain serves as an excellent model for understanding organizational behavior and the challenges of inclusive leadership. Like a leader interested in learning exactly what's going on within their organization, scientists are curious about what's really going on inside the human brain, and have been since we learned that the brain serves as the body's metaphorical CEO. But how do you gain access to what's going on in the brain to learn about how it operates? In attempting to answer this question, neurologists face two major challenges, one having to do with time and the other with space. In the 1920s, neuropsychologists gained information about the brain using the electroencephalogram, EEG, attaching electrodes to the scalp to pick up brain waves. In so doing, they were able to detect exactly when an electric current was discharged. This is very useful information, but it's a little bit like pressing a cup against a wall to listen in on a party next door. You'd know exactly when someone spoke, but you'd be in the dark about where in the neighboring room they were standing. The converse is true of functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, which uses magnetism to measure blood flow in the various parts of the brain. An fMRI provides a 3D image of blood flow, showing which brain regions get activated in response to a prompt. But as with the EEG,